Indulge in the past with History on the Rocks, the podcast that brings you the fascinating tales of lesser known history while you're getting ready for the weekend with your favourite drink in hand. Join Cody and Audrey as they uncork the stories that time forgot, from famous people like George Washington and his distillery to pirate queens causing mayhem on the high seas. Each episode is a journey through the ages with endless possibilities. Go and give them a follow on Facebook and Instagram to keep up with the news about their latest episodes. So grab a glass, relax, and join them every Thursday. History on the Rocks, where you'll learn about the past while sipping in the present. Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts. Today, I thought a change of pace would be in order. I know people tune in for the dark or mysterious tales of history, but sometimes it's just better to leave the heavy stuff for an episode or two. Today, we will celebrate some of the mind-bending, bizarre, absurd, and downright unbelievable stories that have happened in history. Join us as we uncover the weirdest, wildest, and most what-the-fuck stories that have shaped the course of human history. Hi everybody, and welcome back to the Dark History Podcast, where we explore the darkest parts of human history. Hope everybody is well. I'm Rob, your host as always. Welcome to Season 3, Episode Number 6, What the Fuck? Historical Tales, Volume 1. These are going to be some of the most outrageous stories from history that make you go, what the actual fuck is going on? Some of you may have heard them before, others may not have. Believe me, there are tons of these, so I will sprinkle these into the seasons going forward. I know in the past couple of episodes, we haven't got down into the trenches of the death and destruction of years gone by, but the detritus and evil will return. I thought maybe a little palate cleanser would be in order from the moroseness that this channel sometimes can bring. Some of these stories may make you laugh, some may make you upset, but all will make you say, what the fuck? Before we start, I just want to say a thank you to today's sponsor, History on the Rocks. So without further ado, please turn off those lights, sit back, and relax next to the fire for more Dark History. To start, we'll travel to Brazil, a land of rainforests, white sandy beaches, carnivals, and Confederate soldiers. After the Civil War, Southerners who couldn't stand to live in a world without slavery slipped away from the United States. And just like the Nazis would do in the final days of World War II, fled to Brazil. It wasn't just a handful of Confederate soldiers who left the United States forever. Their numbers were somewhere between 10,000 and 20,000. Known as the Confederados, some of these men returned to the States following the Reconstruction, but many of them stayed in South America to build lives and havens for some of the worst people in existence. Fearing recrimination for fighting alongside the Confederate Army during the Civil War, many Southerners left the South in 1865. Former Confederate President Jefferson Davis and General Robert E. Lee pleaded with the Southerners to stay, but many of them refused to stick around and see how things worked out in the ashes of the Civil War. So mass immigration was soon underway. Some of them fled west to the Western Territories, but many former Confederates ventured south. They couldn't imagine a world where a landowner wasn't also allowed to own people, and slavery was still legal in Brazil, so it seemed like a natural fit. Of course, there were plenty of countries where slavery was still legal in 1865. But Brazil wasn't just chosen at random. At the time, Brazil's cotton industry was just beginning to pick up steam. So, Emperor Dom Pedro II offered tax incentives to anybody from the American South, known for its cotton plantations, who wanted a change of scenery. Eager to jump back into the fluffy white fray, southern expats, who had also lost their land, accepted the invitation by the thousands. They introduced South America to southern cuisine like chess pie, had children, and created lineages of people who felt indebted to the Confederacy long after its death. The Confederados also considerably boosted the country's slave trade. In 1866, Charles G. Gunter, a former Alabama state representative, paid $12,500 for 40 slaves, a steal compared to what he would have paid a decade earlier in the United States. Other Confederate loyalists took part in the South American government, like Colonel William Hutchinson Norris, who served as the Imperial Congressman for the state of Sao Paulo. Meanwhile, Major Langford Hastings of Ohio, notable for creating the Hastings Cutoff, the alleged shortcut to California that played a major factor in the Donner Party's final days, wrote The Immigrant's Guide to Brazil during his time in South America to bring even more expats. Despite the backing of Emperor Pedro and a still robust Atlantic slave trade in South America, most southerners were unable to recreate the plantation life that they were so obsessed with. They failed for several reasons, but primarily because they didn't speak Portuguese and didn't know anybody. Without a hookup, there was no way for these people to purchase slaves. Before they could find one, Brazil went and outlawed slavery in 1888, and the Confederados had no idea on how to make profit on cotton without free labour. As their South American plantations failed, and the patriarchs of the southern families started to die out, many Confederados either left Brazil for other parts of South America, or returned to the Union following the end of the Reconstruction. By then, the Jim Crow laws had once again ensured inequality in the South, so it wasn't a total loss as far as they were concerned. Even today, near the town of Americana, there is an annual festival of the Fraternidad Descendencia Americana, or the Brotherhood of the Confederate Descendants in Brazil, who meet up and pay respect to their failed Southern Rebellion by flying Confederate flags and dining on fried chicken and vinegar pie. For our second story, we head to 19th century Paris, a city famous for romance. You wouldn't be surprised to know that the City of Lights was the birthplace for the most kissed woman in the world, but it's the way she's being kissed that will surprise you. The Paris Morgue strived as a tourist attraction throughout the 19th century. Founded in the year 1804, the Morgue was located on the Ile de la Cité. At the time, Parisians began to socialise, and the Free Theatre was the theatre of death. In 1864, it was shifted to a bigger location at the edge of the River Seine, and there are two reasons for this. One is to easily pick up corpses off the street and the river. These were generally unidentified, and the open morgue helped with identification. Two, the area surrounding the river drew in lots of tourists and visitors and provided increased visibility. Needless to say, La Morgue was at the peak of its attraction and was open every day of the week from early morning to 6 p.m. At the morgue, the bodies were stripped naked, inspected, frozen, and then laid on a block of black marble stone. Freezing water dripped from the ceiling to slow down decomposition, but this gave the dead a bloated, blotchy appearance. After 3 days, the bodies were removed due to decomposition and were replaced by a plaque or a wax cast. Once, there was a young woman, about 16 years of age, found in the River Seine. Though no cause of death was found, it was suspected that she had committed suicide. An attendant at the morgue was fascinated by her calm smile and took a death mask of her face. Her body was put on display at the theatre of death, and her appearance drew lots of people, or so the legend says. Soon after, her death mask was hung at the morgue, and people started assembling for a likeness of the cast as a souvenir. The masks started selling like hotcakes in gift and facsimile shops, and everybody wanted one of the otherworldly plaster masks. Soon, it became fodder for creativity for writers, poets, and artists. Since the poor drowned girl was unidentified and her background was unknown, people were able to romanticize her life. A failed love story, perhaps. Maybe that is why she committed suicide, but nobody ever knew. Her masks spread from France to Britain, Germany, and then other parts of Europe. Astrid Lundahl was a toy maker based in Norway. In his early career during the 1940s, he made children's books and small toys made of wood. Later, he proceeded to make soft, malleable toys out of a newfound material called plastic. One of his most popular dolls was a female with half-closed, sleepy eyes and a calm smile called Annie. It started one day when Lundahl's son, Thor, fell into an unknown source of water and nearly drowned. Lundahl fished his son out of the water and pumped his chest to push out the water, and Thor was saved. This incident made Lundahl sympathetic towards saving people from drowning. When a group of anesthesiologists approached Lundahl to make a life-size doll on the process of CPR, or cardiopulmonary resuscitation, Lundahl was immediately interested. Keeping Annie as an inspiration, he wanted a face that moved people's hearts. Then, he remembered the plaster mask of l'Inconnue de la Seine in his mother-in-law's house and recreated its face for the CPR doll. The mannequin was named Annie after the doll, and it later became known as Resusarani. The mannequin had a collapsible chest for simulating compressions and slightly open mouth for mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. He was especially firm on the doll being a female, as men at the time were reluctant to kiss a male doll. Over the years, many CPR dolls came into the market, but the most famous one was always Annie. Many practiced mouth-to-mouth resuscitation on Annie, hence becoming the most kissed woman in history. Our next and final two stories of this episode give meaning to the luck of the Irish. Violet Jessop was born on the 2nd of October 1887 near the city of Bahía Blanca in Argentina. The daughter of Irish immigrants William and Catherine Jessop, she moved back to England at 16 following the death of her father. After initially enrolling in a convent school, Violet left to provide money for her large family when her mother became ill. She secured a job as a stewardess aboard the RMS Orinoco, travelling between England and the Caribbean. In 1911, Violet joined the White Star Line and was assigned a job on the company's brand new flagship ocean liner, the RMS Olympic. Olympic was the first of three Olympic-class transatlantic ocean liners built in Belfast to be the new gold standard in luxury transatlantic travel. Her sister ships were the Titanic and the Britannic. While Violet was on the Olympic, the liner collided with a Royal Navy destroyer, HMS Hawke, in the Solent shortly after leaving Southampton. The Olympic was badly damaged and had to return to Belfast for extensive repairs. The incident cost the White Star a fortune after an inquiry found the company was to blame for the collision. This led to not only an enormous repair bill and a loss of revenue, but also a large legal bill. In 1912, Violet was offered a position on the newly completed RMS Titanic. The heart-stopping collision with the HMS Hawk aside, she enjoyed her time at the Olympic and was reluctant to leave. However, a friend persuaded her that it would be a fantastic opportunity, so Violet took the job. The Titanic set sail from Southampton on its maiden voyage on the 12th of April 1915. At 11:40 p.m. on the night of the 14th, Violet was preparing to go to bed when she heard a loud bang, followed by a screeching noise. Dressing quickly, she went to investigate the noise and was horrified to discover that the ship had struck an iceberg. Violet was told to don her life vest and head up to the ship's top deck. As she later put it in her memoirs, to serve an example to passengers who could not speak English about how to behave in a crisis. Eventually, Violet was ordered into a lifeboat. As it was lowered to the water, a baby was thrust into her arms by one of the ship's officers. The lifeboat hit the water and rowed away. Nearly 1,500 people lost their lives that night. Rescue came 3 hours later with an arrival of the RMS Carpathia. As Violet stood on deck, a woman snatched a baby from her arms and ran off. No records exist of what happened to the baby Violet carried to safety. The Carpathia sailed into New York and deposited the survivors of the Titanic disaster. Shortly after, Violet returned to Southampton. 2 years later, World War I broke out, and Violet enrolled in the British Red Cross. Still working as a stewardess, she was assigned to the HMHS Britannic, the youngest of the Olympic class liners. Britannic was requisitioned by the Admiralty in 1915 to act as a hospital ship, carrying troops wounded in the Gallipoli campaign from Greece to England. On the Britannic's fourth trip out on the 16th of November 1916, she struck a mine. The blast caused the ship to flood and fall to one side as it sank. Violet and her fellow crew members gathered on deck, awaiting orders to abandon ship. Despite the order not being given, lifeboats, one of which contained Violet, were lowered into the water. The boats were pulled towards one of the Britannic's giant spinning propellers, which had lifted out of the sea as the ship listed further to its side. To the horror of those looking on, the lifeboat was smashed to pieces as blood spattered the white hull of the Britannic. Violet jumped from her lifeboat, receiving a serious head injury after plunging into the sea. Luckily, she was pulled from the water after the Britannic's captain ordered the ship's engines to stop. For the second time in 4 years, Violet watched one of the White Star Line's mighty ocean liners sink beneath the waves. After the war, Violet went back to work for White Star. Thankfully, her career, following the sinking of the Titanic and the Britannic, was blissfully uneventful. Violet also had a stint working for the Red Star Line and the Royal Mail Line before retiring into a little cottage in Suffolk. The unsinkable Violet Jessop died of congenital heart failure in 1971. She was 83 years old. And finally, John McGrogan was born in 1861 in the Carrick Hill area of Belfast and was the eldest of three boys. In 1902, he married Annie Hannan Duggan. John McGrogan was a merchant seaman for most of his life and spent many years at sea, working as a greaser on board such ships as the Mauritania, the Lusitania and the Olympic before joining the Titanic in 1912 for the delivery trip from Belfast to Southampton. McGrogan may have intended to continue on the Titanic to New York, but on Wednesday the 10th of April 1912, from Southampton, John McGrogan was nowhere to be found. The story goes that while on shore leaving Southampton, John and another man had a few drinks too many and ended up so drunk that they missed the Titanic sailing to Cherbourg. John and his friend attempted to catch the Titanic by taking a train to Fishguard, and then a boat from there to Rosslare, and then a train down to Queenstown on the very southern tip of Ireland, and tried to catch the Titanic. But they were a day too late, so he and his mate decided to get drunk again. A couple of days later, and now low on funds, they then made their way to Dublin, and hence back to Belfast, ready to face the wrath of his wife. Of course, on their journey back to Belfast, Titanic had hit an iceberg and sank to the depths of the Atlantic Ocean. Back in Belfast, the news had come through about the disaster, and John's whole family believed that he was lost on the Titanic. When John arrived at his home, cap in hand, fully expecting to be scolded by his wife, he was surprised to find mourners praying and doing the rosary. You can imagine the shock on these people's faces when John walks into his own wake. And John, who was expecting a bollocking off his wife, finds out he's had his own wake, alive and well. Who says drinking isn't the answer? Anyway, John McGrogan would later rejoin the Titanic's sister ship, the Olympic. He served during World War I and died in 1933. He is buried at the Milltown Cemetery in Belfast. Thank you for taking the time out of your day to listen to this last dark episode. Some of these stories are just utter madness. Violet Jessop, the unsinkable woman, and John McGrogan, the luckiest man alive at the time, both even survived World War I. The story of the Confederates emigrating to Brazil shocked me when I found it. I never knew some of them did that, in the hopes of keeping an abhorrent trade alive. On the other hand, I had heard the story of Russell Sarani before, and I think it's a quite sad story. What makes it sad is the thought her face is so famous now, and we know nothing about the actual woman's life. It brings into perspective our mark on the world, and how will we be remembered, if at all. Anyway, if you could please drop a review on the show, it really does help the podcast out. The more reviews, the more the algorithm pushes the show out there. If you think friends and family may be interested in the podcast, then share it with them. Links to all socials are below. I know adverts can sometimes be a pain, but if you would like ad-free episodes, a link to the show's Patreon is also below. Not only do you get ad-free content, here is where you can find my other podcast, This Week in History. This is a dive into the week's grisly, gruesome, or just random events throughout history. The Patreon is for people who want to support the channel, but don't feel like you have to. As always, if you've been listening for a while and not subscribed, please do that. In that way, you never miss an episode. So with all that out the way, thank you again for listening. Join us next time for our next episode as we delve into another event and more dark history.